Getting pregnant may be easy for some, but others experience great difficulty having a biological child. On today's Please Explain, we're going to look into infertility. And with me now is infertility specialist Dr. Jamie Griffo, director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU Medical Center. We'll also be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Griffo to Please Explain today. Hello.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Is there a simple definition for infertility?
Well, the textbook definition of infertility is a couple trying to conceive for 12 months and not being successful. And while that's a good definition for younger patients, I think you shouldn't wait that long to be evaluated if you're, you know, in the 30s and over 35 especially.
And what are the most common causes of infertility?
Well, today the most common cause of infertility is delayed childbearing. I think the social pressures are that we are to have our children later in life when we're more established. And there's a very clear recognition of a decline in fertility, mainly relating to what happens to women's eggs as they get older.
So way before menopause, there are already problems developing?
You can actually, if you look at population studies, see a start of a decline of infertility or of fertility in the late 20s. It's not very pronounced till about 38 we see a significant blip, and then another blip at 40 and at 42, and at 44 the bottom falls out.
So how treatable is this?
Well, for a lot of patients it's very treatable, but it can be quite complicated using assisted reproduction and basically techniques that increase the chance that one would conceive. You know, the baseline pregnancy rates for patients are somewhere on the order of 10%. It's hard to get pregnant. It takes 13 months for 100% of 25-year-old fertile couples to get pregnant. It's not easy to get pregnant. And the people who get pregnant in one cycle, they all talk. They say, oh, we're pregnant. We tried one cycle. But the people who tried 13 months just smile and say, we're pregnant.
Now, if it's more difficult as you get older, is there a fear that the eggs will not produce as healthy a child as a younger one?
That's a great question. What we see is that there's a decline in the quality of the egg, and they are more likely to be chromosomally abnormal. So the eggs, a woman is born with all of her eggs. In fact, when she's a fetus in her mother's womb, she has about 7 million eggs. When she's born, she has 1 to 2 million, and at puberty, when she starts to ovulate and be fertile, she only has several hundred thousand eggs.
Only several hundred thousand.
Yeah, it's
that could be a lot of periods.
Well, that's the thing. You only need about 360 in a lifetime, and you only need a couple to have a few kids, but they need to be good. But the problem is they sit poised to get rid of half their chromosomes, because as you know, an egg has to have 23 chromosomes, but they sit in a state of what's called meiosis, where the chromosomes get extruded, and that doesn't happen until fertilization and ovulation. And if that happens at 23, you get a different result than if it happens at 43. So there is this decline in eggs, and there are more chromosomally abnormal eggs and lower pregnancy rates because of that.
But so far, we've only been talking about women as the cause of infertility. Males also play a role. But does sperm deteriorate as men get older?
The sperm does deteriorate, but not to the extent that eggs do. There's only a slight decline in fertility with men. Men have germ cells that are continually producing new sperm, and every 90 days you basically have a new population of sperm. So nature's been a little bit different about that.
But some men seem to not be able to produce children, and then the woman has a child with somebody else. Men have low sperm counts, don't they?
Well, 40% of infertility is male factor related. See, it's not always the husband's fault, at least in this field. but
40% is still 40%, almost 50%.
Yeah, it's a very significant cause. You know, there are a lot of techniques being developed for guys with low sperm counts, and they need an evaluation, and there are things to do to correct sperm count abnormalities. Sometimes men are totally azoospermic and have no sperm. And that's a little bit more complicated. Sometimes we can retrieve sperm from the testicle using a testicular biopsy and just get enough that we can use assisted reproduction to help these couples.
And how often is the infertility unexplained, no matter what tests you've done?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, it's about 30 to 40% of infertility is unexplained infertility.
So one-third of all cases are you just never know why.
Exactly. And my view is most of those are just an age-related decline in fertility. And that it's more difficult to get pregnant as you get older, and as you try later, you have difficulty, and there really is nothing wrong. Everything works. It's about egg quality, and if you can get more eggs and better eggs, you get a better chance.
If the pregnancy occurs, Is the couple still called infertile?
In other words, if a patient gets pregnant and miscarries, do we consider them still infertile?
No, I just mean, like, we've said this couple is infertile. They've had the treatments and whatever else, and then miracle of miracles, so they conceive. Are we still calling them infertile, or are we calling them something else now?
Well, if they then try again and have difficulty, we call it secondary infertility, but you don't lose the label. But once you have the baby, you sure think differently about it. It's awful to have infertility. It's very complex. It causes lots of angst. And, you know, for people who haven't been exposed to these patients, it's just really devastating.
My guest is Dr. Jamie Griffo, Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU Medical Center. And we're talking about infertility on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can infertility be a psychosomatic condition?
We don't think so. But certainly there are emotional components to just getting through the difficult times that one has during fertility treatment. A lot of these patients get depressed because, you know, we all expect our lives to go a certain way and we count on being fertile. And unfortunately, for many of us, that's not the case.
And we keep on reading in the paper that fertility rates are declining. Is that because, as you suggested earlier, women are having children at later ages, or are there other factors, environmental factors?
Well, there may be environmental factors, but the main cause of the decline in fertility in our population are two things, delaying childbearing and sexually transmitted diseases. Those are the two major causes. In terms of environmental factors, we're really uncertain about that, but there must be some impact of suboptimal environment.
What about nutrition and overall health?
Well, you know, we don't have good studies that clearly link nutrition and health, but it's just kind of common sense that you would think that you want to have the best environment. Clearly, cigarette smoking has a negative effect in women, and heavy alcohol also. And in men, smoking marijuana does bad things to sperm counts. It doesn't help women either. There's
been
studies. Well, it's probably toxic effect on the gametes, on the eggs or the sperm. Certainly in sperm production, marijuana decreases sperm production. Not to the level where there's no sperm, but there's just less and less of a chance.
And then we even read in the paper that tight underwear in the male can play a role.
Right. There's this whole theory.
The boxer shorts.
Right.
If you want to get pregnant, wear boxers. If you don't want to, wear briefs.
Well, that's based on the fact that the testicle actually sits outside the body and its mean temperature is a couple degrees lower than the body temperature because sperm production is optimal at that temperature. So, yeah, hot tubs and tight pants aren't best for fertility.
You said earlier that sexually transmitted diseases can cause infertility. Are we talking about the big ones like syphilis and gonorrhea, or even the less terrible ones?
Well, syphilis and gonorrhea are less common, but they can be a cause. The more common is chlamydia. That's the main major culprit now. And the mechanism is that there's destruction of the fallopian tubes from the inflammation that the infection wreaks on the female genital tract. The tubes get damaged. It's difficult for the egg to traverse from the ovary to the uterus, and you can't get pregnant. And sometimes you actually get pregnant, but you get pregnant in the fallopian tube, and that's a surgical emergency because
that's ectopic pregnancy.
Ectopic pregnancy, correct.
And if that is not, if the surgery is not performed, it can kill the mother, can't
it? Well, what happens is the pregnancy outgrows its blood supply and ruptures, and then you have an intra-abdominal hemorrhage that can be fatal if not managed properly.
At what point do people usually come to you?
Well, it varies. Some patients come to me because they've been everywhere else and haven't been successful. Some patients come for their initial evaluation. It really is very individual. I think most of my practice really referred by my successful patients. They tend to be your best advocate.
So once you've determined that an individual or a couple has problems with fertility, what do you suggest?
Well, the workup really involves an initial visit with the couple where things like a semen analysis is done, an evaluation of the female is done as well in terms of infection and endocrine disorders, and we also make sure there's no fibroids or cysts on the ovaries, and we make sure that the fallopian tubes are patent by a test called a hysterosalpingogram or HSG, a dye test, to show that the tubes are open. And once we establish that we have all these things functioning and that the woman is ovulating, we then get to the point of resorting to fertility treatment, which essentially involves superovulation, which is what's best described as just making a better ovulatory environment and monitoring more carefully so that the sperm is placed at the right time to get a better chance. If that doesn't work, we use stronger medicines that are given by injection that make lots of eggs, and those cycles are a little bit tricky because multiple pregnancy is a potential hazard as well as hyperstimulating the ovaries. But with careful monitoring, we use these quite successfully. And then finally, if those things fail, we move on to in vitro fertilization. There are a number of causes of infertility that are surgically correctable. For instance, fibroids can be corrected by being removed. Endometriosis can be treated through a laparoscope, which is a tiny little video scope that you can put through the abdomen.
Now, endometriosis is when the endometrium wall comes off in larger number. I don't know how to say it. There's a lot of cells coming off instead of just a few.
You know, it's a very interesting disease, and we don't really understand it. The cells that line the uterine cavity, the cells that respond every month to the hormones that grow and then slough at the end of the month and you see come out in the menstrual flow, when those cells get out into the abdominal cavity, get on the tubes or the ovaries, the bowel, the bladder, they are a setup for inflammation, and we're not even certain what the mechanism is, but we certainly see when endometriosis is present, and sometimes we even see like a large collection, like a big ovarian cyst or what's called an endometrioma. Those patients have a very difficult time conceiving without assisted reproduction, and even surgery doesn't help all of those patients. We think the mechanism is immunologic related, that this inflammation interferes with conception, but it's not really clear. But it's clear that if you treat it, we get better results, and IVF can bypass it.
Could you put on the headphones, please?
Sure.
You mentioned in vitro fertilization. In vitro is Latin for in glass, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's anything but in glass. It's actually mostly plastic. But what it refers to is actually taking the eggs from the woman and putting them in the lab and then mixing eggs and sperm in the lab and growing embryos and then placing embryos back into the patient.
I wonder if there is a Latin phrase for in plastic. Jack from West Orange, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Leonard. Leonard, first of all, I want to say your show is a great public service, and I'm an avid fan.
Thank you very much.
Indeed, every lunchtime I listen to you. Your guest is of particular interest to me. My wife and I fit into that bottom falls out category. She's 44, and we just went through our first cycle of IVF. And the question I had was, we suffered some remorse or regret. Our first embryo divided into 8 cells. We were very excited. Then it was implanted, and then it didn't mature. And, you know, the loss of that little life meant a lot to us. But what is it that would cause that not to take in the womb? Why wouldn't that develop? And also, are there any things that I could be doing, you know, from a sperm standpoint that it could increase the chances if we went naturally, et cetera?
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything that you can do.
Yes.
You know, most embryos that we see in nature and in the IVF lab don't make babies. It's not because somebody did something. It's because nature makes 90% of embryos that look fine, you know, appear to grow normally, but they don't make pregnancies. And it's not very different than, you know, if you take a handful of seeds and dump them out into your garden in the backyard, not all those seeds make a plant. Well, embryos are similar. They're not all meant to be viable offspring.
So in effect, we have a lot of pregnancies and only a few actually wind up resulting in a child?
Well, it depends on how you define pregnancy. I mean,
right now there's a big debate. And if we have a fertilized egg, and some people are saying that's the beginning of life, then you're saying that we could have hundreds of them during a lifetime, but most of them are not going to result in a child. Does George Bush know this?
I don't think so. I don't think a lot of people know this. In fact, many embryos are made that are not meant to be a fetus or a baby. Some get actually to an early pregnancy stage and then miscarry. That's nature doing genetic screening, and that's what happens. And
is that more likely with an IVF pregnancy?
No, it is not more likely, but it's much more common than people realize. About 20 to 25% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. So that's also important when you look at pregnancy rates of clinics. You got to make sure you look at the baby rate versus the pregnancy rate because they're not the same. The miscarriages aren't subtracted out of the pregnancy rate, but they are out of the baby rate.
Is there anything else Jack can do?
Well, he's doing everything he can do, and what'll happen is if IVF doesn't work after a certain number of attempts, and you know it's individualized, you have to discuss that with your doctor, then we're faced with a very difficult decision. Do you stop treatment? Do you do egg donation? Because clearly the main problem in a 44-year-old woman is the egg. And if you take that same woman and take an egg from a very young woman, you can take the 5 to 10% pregnancy rate that you have in that patient and turn it into a 55% pregnancy rate just by substituting a young, healthy egg. That's called egg donation. Not everybody's up for that.
Because they want to be the biological parents of both sides.
Right. Although, you know, it's funny. A lot of patients say, gee, I'd rather adopt before I do egg donor. But adoption is donor egg, donor sperm, donor carries a baby, donor smokes and drinks whatever, delivers a baby. You have a birth certificate out there. You have to go through a legal process. And then you have to tell a child a story about why their genetic parents gave them up and make them feel good about it. And fortunately, most adoptive parents are pretty smart about how to manage that, but that can be a problem for a baby. You don't have that with egg donation.
What about the skills of the doctor? I probably shouldn't ask that question, but do different doctors have different success rates with IVF?
Yeah, they do, and some of the differences reflect who you choose to treat, because it's very easy to treat the easy patients and get good rates. But, you know, I think experience has a lot to do with it, and it's not just you don't just go to a doctor when you do assisted reproduction. You go to a team, because there's embryologists involved, nursing involved. There's a lot of people that make this system work, and without a lot of experience and expertise, there can be differences.
Thank you for calling us, Jack.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break and come back with more of your calls to Dr. Jamie Grifo, Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU Medical Center. Our number here, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us for more, Please Explain. We're back with Dr. Jamie Grifo, Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU Medical Center, talking about infertility on today's Please Explain. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Alexandra from Queens, New York, you are on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I actually have a question about the relationship between fertility and polycystic ovarian syndrome. I was actually diagnosed with that after I had my first child, who I conceived very easily. And I'm just unclear as to the effect that syndrome has on fertility. You know, that's basically my question.
Sure, that's a good question. Not all patients with polycystic ovaries experience difficulty in getting pregnant, but a large percentage do. And some have an easy time getting pregnant at one attempt and not at others.
So what do cysts do in the ovary?
Well, polycystic ovaries is actually a syndrome, and it's not one thing, and there's many different causes, and it's not completely understood. But small little follicular cysts on the ovary make hormones that, and mainly androgen-like hormones, which are like male-like hormones, like testosterone, that interfere with ovulation. And often these patients don't ovulate, if at all. And when they do ovulate, the quality of the egg is suboptimal. There's good treatments for this, although some patients require even in vitro fertilization in order to be successful. So there are some things that are correctable inciters of PCOS. So that it need to be evaluated by somebody who understands the process and manage it.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alexandra. Mark from Westfield, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I'm not going to call you Brian. I love the show. Doctor, I just want to give everyone a cautionary tale. I'm way past my prime years now. I'm 48, so it doesn't matter to me. But when I was in, I have two children. One is adopted. What happened was after our first child, we waited a few years. My wife had a ectopic pregnancy, but that wasn't the thing. We discovered I had a low sperm count. I went to a bad doctor, which did not correctly do my sperm counts. They couldn't understand why I had a zero sperm count. Turns out a few years later, I went to another doctor, fertility specialist. They looked at some stuff, and we discovered that I'm a computer worker and that I was working in a computer room right next to UPS, an uninterruptible power supply, and it was right. The monitor was right above the UPS. It was a floor-mounted model, and I basically I basically irradiated myself after a year and a half of exposure, and my low sperm count went to zero. So I just wanted to let you people know, if there are any computer geeks in there, staying away from things like that and from CPUs are a good idea.
Do you think that that might have been a reason for low sperm count, Doctor?
It's possible. I don't really know in this particular case what the exposure was and what electromagnetic radiation waves we were looking at here. Clearly, X-rays can have an impact. High doses of radiation certainly can affect the sperm count. I'm not aware of power supplies, but clearly any type of environmental toxic exposure is not an ideal thing for someone who's trying to achieve a pregnancy. And it's not uncommon for men's sperm count to have great variation from time to time, and perhaps that reflects either nutritional factors or environmental factors, but we see that. So, you know, you can see somebody who has no sperm on a semen analysis, then you check another one and there is sperm, and it's not because the test was done incorrectly, it's because there is that variation.
We go now to Kara from Metuchen. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how are you? Leonard, I love your show when I get a chance to listen. I want to say that I was a successful patient from Dr. Griffo's group several years ago with Dr. Licardi, and I am actually a researcher in genetics at Rutgers University, and I'm doing a study. I'm just starting a study to look at the potential role of genetics in leading to female infertility. One of the things I've looked into is how women who have mothers that had early menopause are themselves likely to have early menopause, and I wonder if this may play a role in infertility as well.
Clearly, the genetics of infertility is an area that requires a lot more research. And there probably and have been several mutations that have been associated with infertility, most of these involving developmental genes in the formation of the uterus and the female reproductive genital tract. But there must be other genetic factors as well that either are a cause or are contributing to infertility, although not in an absolute way, because if it was absolute, then the woman wouldn't be alive to pass it on. But yeah, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area, and fortunately, assisted reproduction helps us treat a lot of these things. But and some people have criticized us because now we're helping people who have a difficult time conceiving, and maybe their children will have a difficult time conceiving. And you know, what I can say to that is those children are as wanted as any children, and you know, hopefully we'll be even better then when they're ready to conceive than we are now.
Thank you for calling us. What about the use of frozen embryos?
Well, as a side effect of in vitro fertilization, we often have more embryos than we need to help a couple get pregnant on a cycle. And, you know, in order to avoid multiple pregnancies or multiple gestation, we transfer on average 2 to 3 embryos at a time, and we often have extra viable embryos. Although it's not uncommon that at the end of the day we only have a couple of embryos. You know, a patient will make 10 eggs and have 8 embryos and only have 2 good ones, and then the other 6 are just not viable and we don't do anything with. But the extra ones we can freeze. Pregnancy rates with frozen embryos are not as good as fresh embryos because the process is a little bit harsh. But we still have a lot of babies from that procedure, and it appears to be very safe, and it's a much simpler procedure to do a frozen embryo transfer.
Is it true that there are often multiple births or a higher incidence births from frozen embryos?
It's more common with fresh embryos, but we see multiple births from all of assisted reproduction because in order to get good pregnancy rates, the more embryos you put back, the better the chance, and the more embryos you put back, the better the chance of multiples. So we're always running this fine balance, although our clinic has worked really hard. By culturing embryos longer to a later stage, we can select them better and put back fewer and get good pregnancy rates. So that's called blastocyst transfer, and that's been really helpful in many cases.
Hannah from Rockland County. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have actually 2 questions. One of them, I've been through 4 IVF cycles myself. I'm only 37. However, the quality of my eggs seems to be very poor. We're now considering egg donation. My question is really about just age, that over time you lose the quality of your eggs. Could it be nutrition over time? I happen to have reflux, and I've probably not had a proper diet for the past 20 years. And can you do anything to improve the quality of your eggs, or is it just you have?
That's a great question. We don't know if you can do anything to improve the quality of your eggs, but certainly anything that improves your health, and especially diet, is not going to hurt your cause any. But, you know, we can certainly see a decline in egg quality and embryo quality in patients even younger than you are, and it's very frustrating. But at some point when IVF doesn't work, we do often resort to egg donation in that situation. And, you know, most patients tend to be successful with that if they're willing to give it a try for a couple of tries if it doesn't work the first or second. But
haven't you tried acupuncture in conjunction with IVF?
Well, that's a great question. Acupuncture, there's a number of studies. In fact, this month's Fertility and Sterility, our kind of trade journal where we publish data to try and help us all get better in the field, has a number of studies looking at acupuncture. And there is a suggestion that acupuncture has a benefit. It's not entirely clear how significant that benefit is and how much it relates to the actual process of acupuncture or just the fact that that's a group of patients who are doing things a little differently. But the fact of the matter is there's no evidence that there's any harm, and a lot of patients elect to do acupuncture. I fully support that. I think there probably is some benefit. I don't think it's a dramatic benefit. I don't know if it affects embryo quality, but we just don't know. There's so many things we don't know.
My guest is Dr. Jamie Griffo, Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU Medical Center. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we are taking your calls for this week's Please Explain at 212-433-9692. Eileen from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much. I guess I just have a call. A friend of mine is right now going through infertility treatments, and I know the doctor touched on this briefly, but I really feel she's not being treated holistically in the sense that all the emotion and all the struggle, I don't believe she's really getting enough help with that. I know that she's going through a lot of grief process when these month after month attempts aren't working, and I wondered if Dr. Griffo could just speak to that and speak to how important it is for these women who are struggling to ask for the all aspects of help from the teams that are trying to help them with their quest.
I think that's a great question. You know, it's very clear how significant an impact infertility has on an individual, the couple, and the whole family. It's devastating. It's awful. It's incredibly depressing. And a lot of these patients are depressed and even need treatment for depression. Most IVF clinics do have a psychologist on staff who handles these kinds of problems and helps people deal with the grief that this process causes and the anxiety that it causes. Our particular clinic has two psychologists who are, you know, available to talk to patients, and there's other just freestanding psychologists out there who are very helpful in this matter, who've been experienced in the field and even themselves. We also have a holistic approach. We have someone who does acupressure and holistic approach to helping these patients get through this process. So I think there's some benefit to these things. I think the real key to all that is just helping someone go through a really difficult time in their life and get them through it. And it's not easy. It's an awful process.
Thank you so much for your call. And we go now to Alex from New York. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure listening to you. I just had a quick question about recurrent miscarriages and what the doctor feels might be the cause of that, especially if one has the ability to conceive and then 5-6 weeks down the line ends up miscarrying.
Another good question and topic we see a great deal. There's not just one cause of recurrent miscarriage. There are a number of causes. One of the most obvious causes are women who have uterine anomalies. They have what's called a septum, which is an abnormally shaped uterus, which is not an optimal environment to maintain a pregnancy, and those patients lose the pregnancy early. Another cause is genetic, that either member of the couple has a chromosomal rearrangement called a translocation, where they have all the proper chromosomal material, but a piece of one chromosome is stuck to another, and when they make an egg or a sperm, they make an unbalanced gamete, and that makes an unbalanced embryo that can grow for a while and then is lost. Infection is another potential cause. Scarring in the cavity of the uterus is another potential cause. I think a large percentage of the cause of recurrent miscarriage are chromosomally abnormal embryos, and we do have methods to treat that. In fact, using in vitro fertilization, we can actually do what's called embryo biopsy. That's kind of the thing that I'm most famous for. We were the first in the United States, second in the world, to have a baby from this embryo biopsy procedure. And what you can do is take a cell out of an embryo and do genetic testing and make sure that the proper chromosomes are there. We can look currently at 9 to 12 chromosomes of all the chromosomes that exist. And we find that a lot of embryos are chromosomally abnormal. That's why they don't make babies. And those are the ones that can make pregnancies but miscarry. So that's a significant cause.
We thank you for your call. How expensive are all these treatments, and are they covered by most health plans?
Yeah, these procedures are very expensive, but that's the in vitro fertilization. Not every patient ends up in in vitro fertilization. The earlier treatments using oral medications and insemination are much less expensive.
But do health plans recognize that as a legitimate thing to be paid for?
Yeah, it's a problem. More and more health plans are, because more and more consumers are demanding it. But a lot of plans don't cover it at all. And it's, to me, it doesn't make sense, because I don't know how you can call it an insurance policy if it doesn't insure you against medical problems, and this is a medical problem.
Ginger from Rockland County. Hi, you're on the air. Ginger, are you there? Oh, wait, let me try that again. Yeah, hi, Ginger.
Hi. I have a question about my sister. She tried with her husband to get pregnant for a few years unsuccessfully and then ended up adopting. And about a week or 2 weeks after she adopted, she got pregnant. And I've heard this through other friends of friends, and I'm just wondering, do the mother hormones kick in, or is this something that is not so uncommon?
That's a great question. In fact, someone looked at a group of patients who had infertility and then adopted. And it's kind of, you get a skewed information, because you hear about every single case where, you know, couple adopts and then they have a spontaneous pregnancy after years of infertility. You don't hear about the other part of the equation, which is many that doesn't happen to. And so
this is anecdotal science.
Yeah. And you know, there may be some stress-related things that improve the chances. But on any cycle, and any time, no matter how poor your chances are, there's a chance you could get pregnant. And that happens. And that happens to people who failed fertility treatment and then adopt.
Other listeners want to know about whether the birth control pill can have an effect on fertility rates.
Yes, that's a great question. And there's been no studies to show that using oral contraceptives for a number of years prior to trying to get pregnant has any measurable impact on the ability to get pregnant. It doesn't have any irreversible causes of infertility. There are some patients who develop post-pill amenorrhea. They don't ovulate properly initially after coming off of the pill. And sometimes those patients even need ovulation-inducing agents, fertility drugs, to get them to ovulate. Whether that's a side effect of the birth control pill or something else is not entirely clear, because many of these patients have irregular cycles to begin with, and that's why they're on the pill. But there's no irreversible causes of infertility that can be attributed to the pill.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Jamie Griffo. Thank you for being on Please Explain.
Thank you.